This is a Power 98.7 podcast. Now we're talking. Subscribe to Power 98.7 podcasts in iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. There's more on power987.co.za.
Of course, it is a Tuesday. It can only mean one thing. We bring you the Knowledge Bank. Now, in the Knowledge Bank, we make intellectual deposits. That's what we always tell you. Asina mali. But we do have intellectual deposits, that's for sure. So intellectually, we have assets and we are rich, and we invite people who will strengthen that about us. This morning, we make a different kind of banking in the Knowledge Bank, and we go to the South African Constitution. Now, the South African Constitution has chapters, right? So people like talking about the Bill of Rights, and that's chapter 2 of the Constitution. But they don't talk about the other chapters as if they are not significant. So this morning we place some focus on chapters 4 and 5. Now, chapter 4 deals with the issue of parliament, and then of course chapter 5 deals with the president and the national executive. And of course, at the center of all this is whether or not there is the issue of separation of powers between parliament and the executive in the manner in which we talk about from time to time, and whether or not this is a doctrine that is founded in the constitution, or this is doctrine that has been developed into jurisprudence and therefore is sourced from there and not constitutionally sourced. I've got somebody who has sort of started that conversation in the last week, Dan Mafora, research officer at CASAC, to take us through these two important chapters. I've got a constitution on hand. In fact, I now attend Power Talk with this constitution in my briefcase, because people of power at times can be so demanding. Dan, good morning and welcome to Power Talk.
Good morning, Lukona. Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you very much. I mean, Dan, often we talk about the Bill of Rights when we talk about the Constitution, because perhaps that's where we source our greatest entitlements to this democracy. However, there are other chapters in the Constitution. Of course, as much as some deal with traditional leadership, others even deal with procurement issues and the fiscus management in terms of what the Treasury's work is, and outlines even the Reserve Bank. But I want us to focus on chapter 4 and 5 this morning. Parliament being the legislature, of course, at a national level, and the national executive and the president. What can you tell us about chapters 4 and 5, Dan, at a broad overview?
Thanks so much. I think this is an important conversation, and you're right that when we talk about the Constitution, we tend mostly to focus on, you know, chapter 2, which is the Bill of Rights. And mostly because of our history, right, because of where we come from and because of how this constitution came about. But there are other parts of the constitution that are equally important but have been neglected, even by legal academics. There's a shortage of knowledge about chapters like chapters 4 and 5, as you say. So basically what they do, chapter 4, establishes Parliament as the legislative arm of government, which means that it is the arm of government that has the power to make, to amend, and to repeal laws. Mm. And then Chapter 5 of the Constitution establishes the executive, which is the national executive, which is made up of the president and his cabinet of ministers. And in that sense, and I hope, I'm assuming that we will go deeper into them, but broadly that is what they do, and they set out the functions, the powers, and the roles that they're supposed to play in our democracy.
Absolutely, Dan. I mean, first of all, when we talk about parliament in the South African context, its composition actually is by two houses, the National Assembly and the National Council of Provinces. Now, we don't necessarily place a great deal deal of emphasis as other jurisdictions would in terms of the lower house, the upper house of parliament. You know, like if you're in the US and you're talking about Congress, the House of Representatives, but Senate really becomes this body, authoritative, almost in a way that is made to be exceptional to the House of Representatives. And yet we know that some things flow from the House of Representatives to Senate. In South Africa, when we talk about this composition, the National Assembly and the National Council of Province, how do we distinguish between these two bodies, and do they hold, you know, disproportionate power to the other, if at all?
So, you know, there's debate now around this issue of electoral reform, about the status of the National Council of Provinces. Because it is the upper house of parliament, as you said. So the upper house of parliament is the National Council of Provinces and the lower house is the National Assembly. But in truth, the National Assembly is the more powerful house. And simply because of how they are comprised or constituted. So the members of the National Council of Provinces, some of them are delegated by premiers of the provinces, are special delegates as well. And then some of them come from the provincial legislatures of the nine different provinces. And so there's this debate around whether or not, you know, members of the upper house of parliament shouldn't be directly elected by South Africans, as opposed to having this very complex system of getting people, representatives from provincial legislatures, to come to the national to parliament, rather, to national legislature, to fill those seats in the National Council of Provinces. And so the truth is, to be honest, when people refer to parliament, immediately what you think of is the National Assembly, because it is the more powerful house.
And I wonder, Dan, if we do have some clarity as to which pieces of legislation, because I mean, at the heart of it, Parliament really, besides conducting oversight on the executive, it also crafts legislation. Whether that is robustly done or not is another story. But are we aware which pieces of legislation would have to, by necessity, move from the National Assembly to the National Council of Provinces and back to the National Assembly? Because it seems as if some pieces of legislation don't have to make it to the National Council of Provinces. Are we aware which ones end up at the NCOP?
Right. So any bill that affects the provinces must be referred to the National Council of Provinces. So any bill, for example, that would be determining the boundaries, right, of a province. What are the borders of Gauteng, or the borders of Mpumalanga, or any such thing, would have to be referred to the National Council of Provinces and be tabled there. And the council would be entitled to make amendments to that bill, which would then have to be referred back and then be passed in the National Assembly. And so there are those bills that, which are called ordinary bills, that don't have to make it through. But of course, there's always the option of the National Council of Provinces having a look at them and deliberating on them. But the National Assembly does not have to take those amendments into consideration when passing a final text of the bill. But every single bill that affects a province in any kind of way must go to the National Council of Provinces for consideration.
I suppose then this would be the reason as to why, when, for example, a municipal council is being dissolved by an MEC, for example, a letter is quickly dispatched to the minister responsible, which in this instance would be COCTA, and then the NCOP has to give concurrence or decline that intervention to dissolve a municipal council by way of putting it under administration. I suppose that emphasizes the unique role that the NCOP plays, because that matter does not necessarily flow to the National Assembly at all.
Absolutely. You're correct. You're absolutely correct on that.
Now, Dan, there is a lot of debate about, you know, the forms of legislation that can be passed. The most controversial pieces of legislation seem to be those that seek to amend the Constitution itself. We are currently dealing with the issue of Section 25. Of course, Section 25 falls under Chapter 2, the Bill of Rights. It seems as if different amendments need to attract different majorities within the House.
Right. So the Constitution has what we call entrenched provisions. So when you look at Section 1 of the Constitution, which establishes the Republic and set out the founding provisions, it can only be amended by a 75% vote of the National Assembly, plus a supporting vote of at least six provinces in the National Council of Provinces. And then you have Chapter 2, which is the Bill of Rights, and those can only be amended by a two-thirds, a vote of two-thirds majorities, and a supporting vote of at least six provinces in the National Council of Provinces. So the reason for this is that there are some values or some rights, some principles that are so fundamental to the existence of this country that it must be by consensus almost that they should be changed, right? Mm. We don't want to change them willy-nilly. They are the foundations on which this country is built. And so they are protected by the Constitution itself to say, if you want to change this, you need to have at least a supermajority in the case of the founding provisions and a two-thirds majority in the case of rights, specifically because you want to protect against the tyranny of majorities. And so you set the standards very high so that if these things need to be changed, you are completely confident that a majority or an overwhelming majority of the populace is in favor of them.
Dan Mafora is my guest, research officer at CASAC. I'm going to take a short ad break and come back and continue this conversation. This morning, we place focus on Chapter 4 and 5 of the Constitution, as the first part dealing with Chapter 4, Parliament, the Houses of Parliament, the pieces of legislation that can be moved, the majorities that need to be attracted, especially if those legislative pieces are about amending this Constitution itself. Of course, it has been amended a number of times. In actual fact, one of the amendments were those making the Concord, the apex court of the judiciary. Well, 0861-987-000 is the dial this morning. That's where you find us if you want to talk about this Constitution that has turned 25 years this year, serving us well, not at all without contestation, though, in terms of how it operates. And before we get to Chapter 5 about the President and National Executive, I will ask Dan about this issue around the assenting of bills, where sometimes they sit on the President's desk for 5 years before he can do something. 22 minutes past 11.
Knowledge Bank.
Indeed, it is the Knowledge Bank between 11 o'clock and 12 p.m. As we take you through chapters 4 and 5 of the Constitution, Parliament and the Executive, to be precise. Now, Dan Mafora is my guest. 0861-987-000 is the dial for you to join in. Now, Dan, before I get to the assenting of these bills, let's talk a little about, you know, the necessary public participation for these two bodies to work properly, that being the National Assembly and the National Council of Provinces. In fact, a few years ago, there was an attempt to rework the public participation framework by the NCOP for Parliament, just to make it more meaningful and less about, you know, tick box exercise. Now, what's your sense, though, when we talk about public participation? Because I get the sense that at times politicians themselves tend to blur the lines, and they'll tell you the public participation had over support for a particular piece of legislation. But it's not necessarily just about the how many people, rather than the quality of the debate and discussions that help to crystallize certain parts of that legislation, or in fact lead to the abandonment of the mooted piece of legislation altogether. What's your sense in terms of how public participation is being conducted, and whether or not it really accords with the ethos of our Constitution about this being a people's democracy?
Right. Yeah, I think you're absolutely correct that, you know, it's not meant to be a box ticking exercise. People, well, South Africans are meant to have a valuable input in how laws are made, right? And that's why by the time usually that public participation hearings or public hearings are held, you will have a draft bill or a version of the bill that is already before Parliament and have people's input on it. And the next step would then be to, you know, question whether or not MPs have taken those views that were expressed by the public into consideration when preparing, you know, the next bill. And if people's concerns persist, you know, that could later be grounds for a challenge as to the actual effectiveness of the public participation process. And I think this has been done in the past as well, where people have gone to court to challenge Parliament's adopted procedure when conducting public hearings. And so it is quite important, and I think in the recent past, Parliament has kind of become a lot more receptive to public views on legislation, and especially, as you mentioned earlier, on the amendment of Section 25. And so there is value in public participation, and we all should make an effort to be part of that.
Now, Dan, of course, Parliament takes a vote. NCOP takes a vote. If there are any amendments, they take it back to the NA. NA takes a vote. And then the matter is sent to the union buildings for the president to consider. Mm. Great debate being held in various circles as to whether or not there shouldn't be a regulatory mechanism that puts time frames as to when a bill, would have been passed by a parliament and sent to the president, and when the president decides, you know, to consider the bill. In some instances, we've seen presidents send bills back for, you know, constitutionality considerations, where they think that the bill, if taken for constitutional certification, it wouldn't pass a constitutional muster. But in some instances, it seems as if on controversial bills, on controversial issues, the president can just sit on the matter for time into the future and beyond their term. Is there anything that you believe, and I'm not going to necessarily say as CASAC, but also yourself as just as a legal scholar, that you think is missing and could frustrate the very work of Parliament if Parliament has passed a bill that the president disagrees with?
Right. I think you raise a very important point, and this might be a gap in our constitution, because it doesn't, right? It doesn't regulate the what happens between the time when a bill is passed and when it's assented to, and perhaps something like a time bar of, say, I don't know, 30 days after or 60 days after being passed, the bill would automatically come in effect if the president hasn't assented to it. I think something along those lines, if the president hasn't sent it back or assented to it in that period, then it becomes operational. And maybe that could actually be included in the legislation itself, you know. But there are options of getting around that. It is a gap in our constitution. And as you say, the president is able to kind of just sit and wait until whenever to sign a bill into law. But there isn't any reason why that should be if he is not concerned about the constitutionality of a particular bill. It should be signed into law.
Absolutely. Dan, I'm going to go to Power News headlines, but that's an important consideration, especially when we are entering this season of what appears that we might have a hung parliament one day, and the president might not necessarily be the president who agrees with everything that happens in that parliament, but parliament would have agreed on it on behalf of the people. So this is why it's important to continuously interrogate this constitution, what it makes possible, what it may have as a limitation and how do we repair those limitations. 0861-987-000 is the dial as I continue my conversation after Power News headlines.
Power Talk with Lukhona Mbini. Call Lukhona on 0861-987-000.
Indeed, you can, and you can also actually send me a tweet at Lukhona Mbini, hashtag Power Talk, this morning as we continue our conversation with Dan Mafora, looking at chapters 4 and 5 of the Constitution. And we'd like to hear what you think about it. Dan, now we know that, you know, at its first sitting, the National Assembly must elect a speaker, and that speaker presides over the election of other officials, the deputy speaker, but most importantly, the election of the president. And the president is the head of state and head of the national executive and must uphold, defend, respect the Constitution as the supreme law of the Republic and promotes the unity of the nation and that which will advance the Republic. These are constitutional provisions. Give us a bit overview of, there's been a great deal of debate, and not least the former Deputy Chief Justice Tikgang Moseneke speaking once, talking about how much the president has these vast powers, which might actually be to the detriment of our democracy. What's your view on that debate?
Right. So I'm just going to correct you quickly and say that the Chief Justice presides over the election of the president, not the speaker. But you are right that...
Does the Chief Justice not preside over the election of the speaker then? No, we have to go back to that one. the Chief Justice presides over the election of the speaker. Anyway, carry on. I'll find it because I have a copy here.
It's in section 86.
That's all.
So you are right completely that, you know, there's been debate.
Dan, I must give it to you. I made a mistake. Okay, I must admit. Who am I? You are the guru here. The Chief Justice must preside over the election of the president. Okay.
You're an epistemic trespasser, Lukhona.
At least I admit to my trespassing ways so that I'm not arrested, especially not on air. Ow.
So the question that has arisen recently is whether or not, you know, the president has, or there's too much concentration of power in the president.
Yes.
And this arises specifically, as you say, from a speech that was given by the former Deputy Chief Justice Moseneke in 2014, where he said basically that this is Mandela's constitution, right? So it was designed with this man in mind, and the negotiating parties or the Constitutional Assembly was comfortable investing these very broad powers in the office. But the question is this still viable? Is this still a good way for us to divide or allocate public power? And the issue here is obviously that the Constitution is very clear. It says the executive authority of the Republic is vested in the president. And I mean, that's quite a serious concentration of power. And it also says that he has the power to appoint ministers and the deputy president and allocate their powers and functions. And so it's quite a lot of like discretionary power that is vested in the president, in addition to other appointment powers across the Constitution and across thousands probably of other pieces of legislation. And the question is it time to kind of trim? Is it time to move to a more collective decision-making where you have cabinet acting by consent or by majority, or some kind of collective or central executive authority, as opposed to having the president being the sole bearer of this power.
Mm. And then I just want to come back to something. You know, when we talk about the president being the head of state and national executive, in some jurisdictions, they will separate these roles between the president and a prime minister. The fact that they vest in one individual here in South Africa, and it's not only peculiar to South Africa, it happens elsewhere, but as in most, though, there's a separation of who looks after the national executive. prerogative and who looks after, you know, the state. And of course, in Uganda, it's the inverse. The prime minister is actually more ceremonial than the president, rather than what we see in other jurisdictions. But then I wonder, is this concentration of responsibility of both, you know, being head of state and national executive also part of that concentration of power?
Well, that's a very interesting question. In my personal opinion, I don't think so. So, as you said, the one in systems where you have this divide, where you have the prime minister and maybe a president or, you know, a monarch, the other's powers are largely ceremonial, right? And they don't affect the kind of day-to-day running of the country and the lives of the people. But the more executive, more administrative power is the actual one that people should be concerned about, or people should worry about its concentration there, especially where it's largely discretionary and there aren't any checks on how it's exercised. So, for example, an example of the two different powers is the president has the power to appoint a commission of inquiry, which is, you know, an advisory organ. It doesn't make any binding findings, largely a policy tool. That's completely fine. And that's his exercise of his power as head of state. But where he appoints, for example, the National Director of Public Prosecutions, that's an executive power that he's vested as head of government. So there's a serious difference between the kind of two powers, and I don't think that we need to worry about, you know, the former more than we do about the latter.
Absolutely. And of course, Dan, the very fact that this national executive is sourced from parliament, but not just any house in parliament. It seems the National Council of Provinces is insulated because the president may only appoint ministers and deputy ministers from the National Assembly. And this gives us almost what some may call a parliamentary executive. And it brings me to the question that I'm interested in. And the Constitution, funny enough, creates a very open-ended number of people that can actually make their way into cabinet, because it talks about any number, which means that the president could possibly, you know, appoint half of the National Assembly into cabinet if they were malicious and naughty like that. But what does it do then for the ability of the National Assembly, with all its portfolio committees, to robustly be able to hold the executive accountable if members of the executive, by far and large, are members of that institution? Of course, the president can appoint up to two people who are not members of the National Assembly.
I think that's an excellent question, and one that, you know, we need to start grappling with, because the idea of having a cabinet or an executive that is chosen almost exclusively, right, from members of the National Assembly, is that you create an illusion of accountability and oversight, but it's not actually there, because where you have a dominant party like we've had, what you tend to have is executive dominance in parliament, right? As you say, the parliament functions through portfolio committees, and these portfolio committees and their leadership is chosen by the caucus of the majority party largely, and they get political instruction from Luthuli House, you know. So it's kind of like there isn't any real separation between members of cabinet as members of cabinet and then members of cabinet as members of parliament. And it creates a situation where it is quite difficult for portfolio committees to do their work, to robustly hold ministers responsible for their work. Which is something that the Constitution says. It says collectively and individually, cabinet ministers are responsible to the National Assembly for the performance of their functions. But how are you able to do that when these are the same people, these are their colleagues, basically, right? These are the people they sit next to on the benches.
And then further than that, then, if we are alive to political realities, these may also be political seniors to some of the ordinary members of the National Assembly.
Absolutely. So the political dynamics, the internal party machinations and all of those things play a very big role in kind of insulating almost the executive from any form of accountability, especially where you have an overwhelming majority. And maybe things will change now, maybe, you know, as the composition of Parliament or the National Assembly begins to change, we will see a more active role by Parliament to oversee executive actions and scrutinize their work in that way.
Or, Dan, there is an even further risk of consolidating, say, about 60% of 60% of the National Assembly, consolidating it into very different political parties who are represented in the government, and they are trying to be part of a broad patronage network, and then cripple the accountability mechanism. Then this is why I'm often interested in saying, are we able to build in more accountability frameworks into the Constitution? Because I think a lot of it relies on chance, on goodwill, on honesty and integrity of those who occupy office.
So, well, I think you're a lot more of a cynic than I am, right? but what I will say is, I think if we had an executive that was completely divorced from the legislature, you would have, hopefully, in an ideal scenario, you would have kind of a robust accountability mechanism where Parliament would be able to call these people before them and say, account for this, account for this, account for that, without having to fear, you know, backlash from within their parties or things like that. And of course, I'm not sure if there is a perfect system. If you look at the US, they have a similar model to what I've discussed now, but, you know, they have as many problems as we do, it's not something that I have thought about extensively, but I do think that there is a sense in which even within the existing framework, space could be created for a more robust system of accountability.
Absolutely. And I mean, of course, Dan, in some of those jurisdictions, you talk about the US, you talk about the UK, in the House of Commons, we know, for example, you can have backbenchers, which is acceptable to be a backbencher, even if you belong to the party in government. And that's because I think what has gone right there is that legislators can actually disagree with their political party line. Here, the caucus system is very robust, the whippery system. So if a caucus has adopted this, all members of that caucus must adhere to the position that has been decreed by the political parties. Whereas in the jurisdictions that you are talking about, whether the US or the UK, you can actually disagree with your party and nobody's going to hold a big stick and tell you about, you know, they're going to expel you from your organization. I've got Mutomani on the line. Mutomani, good morning.
Morning, Muramguni again.
Good morning, Buti.
And Dademafora, how are you? Hey, your guest is not.
No. I think it was my fault. Dan is there. Dan Mutomani is saying hello.
Hi, how are you, Mutomani?
I'm all right, bro. I wanted to find out. I just hope that I'm not taking you out of your today's topic. But it will relate much more to what I've always asked. In terms of, I know that the master class of...
And I'm building up to that. This is actually part of building up to that, Mutomani, on referendums.
Yes. Now, I wanted to find out from Dademafora that what options do ordinary citizens having in terms of pushing to change the constitution or any law which they are not comfortable with? Let's say we know that we've got a constitution that has been adopted, and along the way, things have changed so drastically, some things we are no longer comfortable with them. Now, political parties will forever protect what suits them. In our ordinary situation as ordinary citizens, when we when we are no longer comfortable with that situation, what options do we have as ordinary people to enforce the changing of the constitution without necessarily have to rely on the parliamentarians?
Okay, got you loud and clear. I mean, Dan, Mudomani is raising something quite important here, especially when you look at the constituency system, which works in reverse. We first elect the parties, and then once they are in parliament, people are assigned to constituency offices. But it's not that robust. There is a process where you can be able to petition the National Assembly on a particular issue as a citizen or other citizens. But man, it can take forever. I know the guys who have been trying to petition for paternity leave, their matter took years and years before parliament could entertain it.
No, absolutely. I think it is quite difficult, precisely because we don't have a constituency system like, for example, the UK, where you have, you know, a member of parliament who is directly responsible for your area that you elected. And so it makes getting involved in the work of parliament quite difficult. And as you say, you have to petition, and that can take forever because it's not necessarily, you know, something that MPs are delighted to do. But there are limited ways, I'll put it like that, for us as ordinary citizens, even beyond just getting involved in the portfolio committee system, in public participation hearings, to actually be involved directly with the work of parliament. And that is something that we need to start looking at reforming.
I mean, Dan, it took the Concord, in fact, to emphasize to parliament that private members' bills could actually be entertained as much as those bills that flow from national departments. And at the heart of that was, I mean, at the time, the Ambrosini issue of the IFP, who wanted to introduce a private members' bill on the use of cannabis for medicinal use, da-da-da-da-da. And because he was opposition, some believed that, you know, we don't have the duty to really entertain, where majoritarianism was being used to frustrate the voice of opposition. And in fact, now we are seeing more private members' bills, whether it's from the EFF, the Congress of the People, being presented before parliament and being taken seriously. Do you think that even the representatives themselves who are in parliament have not always ordinarily opened up the space beyond the concept of which party is the majority and therefore it should dictate the direction of legislation making?
Absolutely, 100%. I think you've hit the nail on the head by pointing out just how this process has tended to be party dependent, right, or party driven, and this idea that because we got the most votes in the last elections, we will drive. We are the people who are, or the only people rather, who are, you know, or who should have the right to introduce legislation and reforms and things like that. Whereas that is a right that every member of parliament has, and that had been, until the Ambrosini case, being minimized in such a way that opposition parties were there just, you know, to oppose and not to bring forth ideas and proposals and such things. And we see now that is growing. And I mean, there are a couple of bills under consideration now that were introduced by minority parties, as you said, or members of minority parties that are actually gaining traction, that are being discussed in the kind of nonpartisan way that we want parliament to function. But I think that is also an avenue that we will see grow as we go forward.
Absolutely, Dan. Let me invite the people of power, if they have a question or a quick comment, to put through 0861-987-000 is the dial this morning as I continue my conversation with Dan Mafora, Research Officer at CASAC. We are focusing on chapters 4 and 5 of the Constitution this morning, Parliament, the President, and National Executive. Now, Dan, another issue that has served before the Concord, which has opened up interesting debate, is the issue around Section 89, the removal of the president, what some people are trying to call an impeachment clause. There isn't a great finality whether or not this can be referred to as an impeachment clause, but it is often placed against Section 102 of the Constitution, which are motions of no confidence, and of course those can be motions of no confidence on the president or motion of no confidence on the national on the cabinet itself, because I mean parliament can vote for the dissolution of cabinet excluding the president, and then the president must reconstitute. That is not always known, and of course then if they pass a motion of no confidence on the president, automatically the cabinet dissolves and the deputy ministers must resign. Now, the Concord, I remember Mokgweng leading the charge there quite a lot in that hearing and saying, you know, 102, the bar is too low. You can wake up not feeling like you like the president. There's no reason that needs to be put. But Section 89 needs a serious vote, and it's not just by a majority. Section 89 needs a 2/3 of the members of the National Assembly. And there are three issues that are stated there: a serious violation of the constitution or the law, serious misconduct or inability to perform the functions of office. The debate around Section 89 really is whether or not it's an impeachment clause. And I wonder, Dan, what I've always wondered about is, I mean, if you say a violation of the constitutional law, once the court says, yes, indeed, the president has violated the law, then why do you still need a 2/3 of people to decide whether or not the president must go if that is an impeachable offense?
Right. I mean, this is the debate that was at the heart of that second EFF judgment where former Chief Justice Mokgweng penned that very fiery dissent, right, about what role should the National Assembly play prior to the vote, right? So you what role should they play before bringing an impeachment vote or an impeachment motion or a removal motion to the vote? And the idea is the difference between a motion of no confidence and a removal or impeachment is that an impeachment is punitive, right? So if you're impeached, yeah. If you've been found to have committed a serious contravention of the constitution or the law or gross misconduct, then you lose all of the benefits that come with having been president. And so the reason why the bar is so high is, one, the power to remove a president is given to the National Assembly, and two, they need to first establish and satisfy themselves as the National Assembly that these grounds for removal exist before putting this thing to a vote, unlike a motion of no confidence, which is similar to what they do in the UK, where you have lost the confidence of the Commons, you no longer have the right to form a government, and then you call in a new election. And so it is still kind of a raging debate, although I thought EFF2 had settled that question. but it is clear that we need a process before we put it to the vote just to make sure that the exercise of that punitive power by Parliament is actually justified.
And I suppose, then, the last part, I mean, I know you'd want a whole masterclass on this, but, you know, this is not how things work here. It lands us on this question that you raised as to whether or not the idea of separation of powers is constitutionally derived, or it is, something that comes from jurisprudence and case law. And of course, I mean, it might be much more clearer as to how the judiciary is independent to the executive and the legislature. But in the context of the conversation that we have heard about the president nominating or appointing his cabinet from the National Assembly, surely the issue of separation of powers becomes even much more difficult to navigate.
So you're absolutely right. And so the difficulty here is that the Constitution doesn't explicitly say that there is a separation of powers, right? Well, we get that it is there because it's implicit in how the Constitution divides the power, legislative, executive, and judicial power. But in the previous constitution, the 1993 constitution, it was, I think, constitutional principle number 6, which was very clear that there shall be a separation of powers. Then the question is, how clear or how sharp is that separation when, as you say, the members of your executive are also members of parliament? What does that mean for the involvement of members of the executive in the work of parliament? Where do you draw the line? What is admissible or permissible and what is not? How far can courts go in regulating how these two arms of state exercise their powers, and why do they not have the power to regulate how courts exercise their powers? I mean, there's lots and lots of questions to think about today. But what is important and what will become important, I think, later on, is we will begin to see a clearer picture emerging, I think, as the composition of Parliament changes, between how Parliament and the executive have been working and whether or not there was a true separation, and whether or not frictions will begin to arise because of how they've been working. Obviously, the courts are in the clear because, you know, they're all open and we see how they work, at least for the most part. Yeah. But these two other arms of state are still up for question.
Not so much. Even cabinet deliberations are not public, so we don't even get the minutes, just the decisions. Dan, if this were a thesis, those parting shots would be what we consider future research questions. Thank you so much for spending time with us this morning.
You've been listening to a Power 98.7 podcast. For more podcasts, visit power987.co.za or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.